Today we try to give a first definition of what quantum phases and quantum phase transitions are. And to this end, we need to review some notions of classical phase transitions, which you probably have already encountered in the course of statistical mechanics. So I will be quick here. Nonetheless, I want to show some relevant features of classical phase transitions. And so, as you know, it all starts with the free energy, which we write in this way, where Z is the partition function of the system, which is the sum over all the configuration of the system of V to the minus B, the energy of the system that we call it H as the Hamiltonian function. And as an example, we already yesterday introduced the classical Ising model in which we have Ising variables that can be plus one and minus one. And this is the Ising coupling, and this is the so-called external field. And OK, so we are interested in, OK, so this term is sometimes called total magnetization, capital M. We are interested in the net magnetization, which is the magnetization per site. So in particular, we want to know what is this object, the average magnetization per site, which is this object here. OK? So, and you have learned that this is equal to 1 over n, the derivative of the free energy with respect to H. In fact, if you take the derivative of this object, where Z is this, you readily find that this is equal 1 over n, the sum over all the configurations of these Ising spins of M times e to the minus beta H over Z. Right? You're familiar with this. And if you plot this quantity for this Hamiltonian as a function of the temperature, you find, let's say, in two spatial dimensions, if here you have T over Tc, and this is 1, and here you have M, you find something like this. OK? You have it. So you see several things. First of all, that this quantity has a discontinuous derivative here. OK? So this means that the second derivative of the free energy is discontinuous. So this marks a phase transition. And because it's the second derivative and not the first one, we call it a continuous phase transition. Second, this quantity marks two different phases. So this phase is where the average magnetization per site is zero, and we call it paramagnetic. And this one, we have a net magnetization per site, we call it ferromagnetic. And it's a continuous phase transition because this quantity that we call order parameter, because it distinguishes the ordered phase from the disordered phase, is a continuous quantity, although it has a discontinuous derivative. That's why we call it a continuous phase transition. OK, so far so good. So what is this second derivative that is discontinuous? We call it a susceptibility chi. So we just take the derivative with respect to H of M, and then we will compute it at h equals 0. So this tells us how our order parameter is susceptible to small variations of the field starting from 0. Okay? So you simply have to take the derivative of this object, and this is a simple exercise, and what you will find is that this is equal to 1 over n, and then you find the average of m square minus the average of m square. Okay? Are you familiar with this result? Okay. It just comes from differentiating this object with respect to h. Very well. Now, by the way, this is also an example of the so-called fluctuation dissipation theorem. So you see that the dissipation is what is a word to indicate the linear response of the system to an external perturbation. So the linear response of the system is given by the fluctuations, because these are fluctuations, right? Very well. So now we see a first very important element is that when this derivative here at the critical point diverges, the fluctuations diverge. Okay, so there are very large fluctuations. This is what marks a phase transition. And we immediately need to understand what could happen in the quantum case, because why there are fluctuations to start with? Because we have a probability distribution. See, fluctuations are given by the fact that we can take averages of these quantities. So if we really want to understand phase transitions as something that has very large fluctuations, we need to keep in mind when we discuss the quantum case, what is the nature of fluctuations in a quantum system. The second thing I want to show you is that by inserting the definition of m in here, one can write this quantity as, I think I forgot the beta here. Okay. One can write this quantity as beta over n, and then we have the average of sigma I, sigma j, the sum of all of them, minus the square of this. Okay? Now, let's simplify our life a little bit and imagine that we have a translational invariant system such that the average of a variable at one site is equal to the average at every other site. So there is nothing that breaks this translational invariance. So we can substitute the value of sigma j with some reference value sigma 0, and then the sum of sigma j would give us always the same contribution, and we get it n times so that we get rid of n here. So we can write it this as beta, the sum over j of sum over I, sigma 0, minus, and we here have the sum over I of sigma zero square. Yeah. Okay. Now, we want to call this object So I can also take the n out and take the sigma I here. Okay. So this object here, we call it gamma of I con, and these are the connected correlation functions. So you see that chi, our susceptibility, is the sum over all the connected correlation functions that connect a site 0 to the site I. In general, given any observable or any operator, the connected correlation function Cij will be defined as the average of Oi Oj minus Oi Oj. And what does it mean? You know that this is a measure of the correlation between fluctuations, because a very quick calculation shows that this is equal to the average of omega OI minus OI times OJ minus OJ. Okay, so this is a measure of the fluctuations around the average at two different sites, of the correlation between the fluctuations. Okay. So now, what happens at the critical point? Well, first of all, we have that the order parameter around the critical point is diverging. We write this by saying that m near to this critical temperature diverges with the critical exponent beta. And here I will write critical exponents for the Ising model in two special dimensions. And dimensionality is very important. And beta is equal to 1 over 8. OK. The other thing that happens is that the non-connected correlation functions, gamma I, so the non-connected correlation functions are just sigma I, sigma 0, have two very different behaviors at low and high temperature. So at high temperature, they decay exponentially. And the scale at which they decay is called correlation length. However, at very low temperature, they actually do not decay at all. They scale like the value of sigma 0 square, which is different from 0, right? Because it's basically this given by this guy. So you see that at the critical point, psi, in order to go from this behavior to this behavior, at the critical point, psi must diverge. There is no other way that you can connect this behavior to this other behavior without making psi diverge. And in fact, at the critical point, when t is equal to tc, gamma I decays as a power law, so it is I to the minus d, this is the spatial dimensions, minus 2 plus eta, and eta is a new critical exponent, which is equal for this model to 1 over 4, I believe. Yes, 1 over 4. As a consequence, Psi, as we anticipated, at the critical point, has to diverge and diverges as t minus tc to the minus nu. And nu is equal to 2 for this model. Okay, so these are called critical exponents. Okay, so pretty much this is what I want to say about classical phase transitions. So we see that the critical point is marked by the fact that we have infinite correlation length, and the infinite correlation length means that correlation spins are correlated at large distance. We have long range correlations. Notice that when t is when t is much smaller than the critical temperature, we have a long range order, meaning that you see these guys do not decay, so at every distance there is order, but the connected correlation functions would be zero. So there is long range order, but not long range fluctuations. The connected correlation functions is this, so you also have to subtract this, measure the correlations between fluctuations. So at low temperature, you have order, the system has magnetized, but there are no fluctuations, basically. In the paramagnetic phase, there is neither long-range correlations nor long-range order. At the critical point is the point where we have long-range correlations in the fluctuations, because it's where the connected correlation functions decay as a power law. Very well. So what happens now? Let's try to understand the quantum system, okay? Quantum phase transitions. And again, we would like to say that quantum phase transitions are marked. Yes?
Where did you say the first equality came from? Like in the middle of the board, dmdh equals this.
Which equality, sorry?
Equality, like beta over n, m squared minus m squared. Like,
okay. So if you take the derivative of this, okay? Well, then you have to differentiate with respect to a small h, this fraction, basically, right?
And
well, then what you get would be 1 over z squared. And then when you differentiate the Hamiltonian, e to the minus beta the Hamiltonian, you see you get m.
And
you know, you do a bit of math and you find that.
And your definition of Cij?
That's a definition. That is the definition of connected correlation functions.
I read theta I theta j minus theta I theta j.
It is the average of OI OJ minus, oh, sorry. Yeah, thank you. Very bad typo. And this becomes OI squared for a translational invariant system. Okay, thank you for well, okay. For our translation invariant system, the second piece is the sigma zero, the average of sigma zero squared. Okay, so now in the quantum system, okay, again, we would like to look for domains of non-analyticity. of the free energy density, and we expect that at the critical point, our fluctuations are correlated at large distance. So where do these fluctuations come from now? Because this is what we have to pay attention to. Well, you remember the discussion of yesterday? These averages now depend on two probability distributions. So whereas here, every time I use this symbol, I'm taking an average, what this means is that I am summing over all the configurations, and then I have this probability distribution, and here I have whatever I'm averaging on. And so you see, this is the Boltzmann probability distribution. So the fluctuations come from temperature. Because we are at finite temperature, there is a probability of being in a certain configuration instead of another, and this gives us fluctuations. We have thermal fluctuations. But now in a quantum system, we also have fluctuations from the fact that taking the average of an operator also means, actually always means this. As we saw yesterday, and rho contains fluctuations in two ways. It contains fluctuations that are thermal because we assign a distribution over pure states with a thermal probability, and it does contain fluctuations because in every pure state, even if rho is pure, you have a probability distribution, therefore you can have fluctuations. So you see, if we looked at divergence in the correlation of the fluctuations in a quantum system, we wouldn't know if this comes from the fact that the fluctuations are thermal or from the fact that the fluctuations are quantum. Sure enough, this is a quantum system, but we would not be able to distinguish the quantum fluctuations from the thermal fluctuations because they're both there. So if we want to understand the phase transitions in a quantum system that are purely quantum, we need to get rid of the thermal fluctuations. And how do we do that? By sending beta to infinity, or which is the same, the temperature to zero. Why? Because your state, your equilibrium state, rho, that in quantum mechanics is the Gibbs state, where this now is the Hamiltonian operator of the system, at beta going to infinity, so zero temperature, becomes what? The ground state. Right? Well, since this is an operator, e to the minus beta h, is nothing but this operator, the sum over all the energies of e to the minus beta e, and then the projector onto that energy. Okay, and then you are dividing this by z, that is just this part. You see that when beta goes to infinity, only the smallest of v survives in the limit of beta going to infinity, and so you are left with the projector to the ground state. So in the ground state, now we do not have a thermal distribution, it's just one state, or if you have the degeneracy, it is a few states, but you do not have thermal fluctuations. So in the ground state, only quantum fluctuations. Okay. So what plays the role of the temperature? Because now the temperature has been frozen. We are at T equals zero. So when we look at the transition between a ferromagnetic and a paramagnetic phase, what are we looking at? Right? Because we cannot change the temperature anymore. Well, so remember that our Hamiltonian depends on some external parameters. Let me call them in general lambda. So let me write it like this. Our Hamiltonian is the sum over local operators that depend on some parameters lambda. This lambda is actually, in general, not one number, but it's a vector of numbers. Lambda 1, lambda p. Okay? Example, the quantumizing model that we introduced yesterday depends on only one parameter g. This is equal to minus gj sigma sum over I of sigma xi minus j sigma the link psi j of our lattice sigma z I sigma z j. Capital J here is not really a parameter, it's just a scale. Okay. You just rescale everything with j. It's useful to keep it there sometimes, but doesn't really play any role. But for every g, you have a different Hamiltonian. So this is, strictly speaking, a family of Hamiltonians. And these Hamiltonians are always supposed to be smooth in the parameter lambda. By the way, one can prove the fact that the eigenvalues of a operator that depends smoothly on a parameter, these eigenvalues are always continuous. So you cannot have jumps in energy. But you could have jumps in the derivatives of energy. So what is the picture here? The picture here is that you have a manifold of parameters. Like, okay, so this is lambda 1, this is lambda 2. And what is that has a discontinuous derivative? Well, it is the free energy at t equals 0, right? We have taken beta to infinity. And this means that the free energy density, which is f over n in the limit of large n, at t equals 0, becomes just the energy at t equals 0, which is the energy of the ground state, over n, which is the energy density in the ground state. So when we say that we have a first order quantum phase transition, means that dE with respect to d lambda for some value of lambda, so sum of these parameters, is discontinuous, or the second derivative. Or some higher derivative. We call these ones first order, and these ones we call them continuous phase transitions for every higher derivative. And again, our phase space now splits in different regions in which the energy density is analytic. And here it's non-analytic, means one of the derivatives is discontinuous. Okay? So this is the phase 1, this is the phase 2, and these critical lines mark the phase transitions. Why we are concerned only with continuous phase transitions? And we don't really care, at least in this course, about first order phase transitions. Well, we already saw in an example here, this was a continuous phase transition. You see that the continuous phase transition is very interesting because at the critical point, you have long-range correlations in the fluctuations, which is what we really find interesting. But there is, in the quantum system, it's easier to see that first-order quantum phase transitions are trivial, are not particularly interesting. Imagine, in fact, that you have what is called the level crossing. So you have some parameter lambda, and here I'm plotting the energy of the ground state and the energy of the first excited state for a quantum system. And you have something like this. Okay? One energy goes down, one energy goes up. At some point, they cross. Let me call this lambda critical. Well, if they cross, actually the energy of the ground state, which is by definition the smallest possible energy, that's like this, right? So you see that the first derivative is discontinuous there. But why this is trivial? Can you tell me why this phenomenon is trivial? Why it might have nothing to do with phases, with the statistical mechanics and anything else. Look at this Hamiltonian. My Hamiltonian is lambda times some energy, that is the initial energy of the ground state, times the projector on some state, plus 1 minus lambda, some other energy, let me call it E1, the projector onto another state. You see that this Hamiltonian features exactly this situation. At lambda critical, this becomes the ground state after lambda critical. At the beginning, this is the ground state. Then the swap. Well, but this Hamiltonian is trivial. Why? Because it's a two-body Hamiltonian. This is not a statistical mechanics phenomenon. The thermodynamic limit plays no role. So there is nothing that has to do here with the creation of order or disorder or fluctuations. There are no fluctuations here whatsoever. So that's why sometimes they are interesting, but usually level crossing is not really interesting. So we, in this course at least, we do not care about it. And we focus on continuous phase transitions. Questions? In the case of the quantum meshing model, our parameter space is just one-dimensional. Okay? And so we have just this coordinate, G. And we would like to understand if this model features different phases, different quantum phases, and if it does feature quantum phase transitions. So in order to address this problem, we should first look at two limits. In the first case, what we would like to call, anticipating some result, the paramagnetic phase. Is in the limit of G going to infinity. So for very large G, this term doesn't count, right? So the Hamiltonian is just this. This is a very easy Hamiltonian because this Hamiltonian is already diagonal in the computational basis. The computational basis, did I define it? So I call 0 the eigenstate and 1 the eigenstate of sigma z. Okay, so you see that you know that sigma x has two eigenvalues that are plus 1 and minus 1. All these terms commute. So in order to find the ground state, meaning minimizing the energy, I have to put every sigma x in its eigenstate. Of what eigenvalue, plus 1 or minus 1? Well, because my coupling is negative, I should put it in plus 1. All these terms commute, so I can minimize the energy by minimizing piecewise each term. This, if I want to minimize the energy of everything, this is much more complicated because they do not commute. So the minimum energy is not the minimum of this with this, the minimum of this, because they do not commute. But just this term is easy. So what are the eigenvectors of sigma x? Well, you see that sigma x on the state so-called plus, which is by definition 0 plus 1 over square root of 2, you see, what does sigma x do on the computational basis? It sends 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. So this goes into itself. So this means that this is an eigenvector of eigenvalue plus 1. And similarly, the one with the minus here is an eigenvector with eigenvalue minus 1. So the ground state of the sum of all these terms is given by the ground state is given by plus on every spin. The first spin is in the state plus. The second spin is in the state plus, and so on and so forth up to the last one, which we can write in this way. Okay, so this is the ground state. It's unique. There are no other ground states. This is the unique ground state of the quantumizing model for g equal to infinity. So let's try to see what is our order parameter here, some tentative order parameter, something that distinguishes the two phases. So because this is some generalization of the classicalizing model, we would like to choose the magnetization, right? So we would like to say that some magnetization in the ground state, its expectation value, I could also do something like this. I could sum over all of them and then divide by n, this would be our quantum average magnetization per site. Since the system is translation invariant, just taking this part without doing this average per site is the same thing. However, so yeah, what do I put here? Because now I have an ambiguity, right? I could put x or z. What do you think I should put? Should I measure the magnetization in the x direction or in the z direction? I mean, I can do that. I can do both, right? But what is the sensible thing to do? remember this. When I measure that average magnetization there, why we call it spontaneous magnetization? Why we say, oh, the Ising model magnetizes below a certain critical temperature? So what did you learn in the StatMac? Why it's spontaneous? What is the value of H when I compute that thing?
Zero.
Okay. And my bad that I didn't write it explicitly. But we are interested with H equals zero. Because who cares about the fact that the spins magnetize if there is an external field that polarizes them? Of course, right? You have three variables. You have an external field. Yeah, so where is the this is not magnetization. The interesting thing of magnetization is that you put some field, maybe you magnetize them, but then you send it to zero. And if the thermal fluctuations are not too large, like below the critical temperature, it stays magnetized at zero magnetic field. Okay? So that's why there are many reasons why this is called spontaneous, but this is the easiest way of describing that. So, but now you see here. Now we do not have a temperature, right? So our ferromagnetic phase is not marked by a temperature that is below TC, but is marked by what? By some parameter G that is greater or smaller than something. Okay. So we would like to have magnetization for a certain range of values of G. Okay, but now you see that G couples to the magnetic field in the x direction. So if I measure the magnetization in the x direction for a finite value of g, I'm not doing anything interesting. It's not the spontaneous magnetization. The spontaneous magnetization must be in the direction that is not coupled to an external field. That's why here we have to put a z. Okay, now let's compute it in this ground state. So I want you to tell me what is this result.
Zero.
Huh?
Zero.
Yes, why it's zero?
It's like the ground state is spins in the x direction of measuring z, so it's averaged to zero.
Okay, yeah, you're saying this is in the x direction. I am measuring in the z direction, so in the z direction must be zero. But these are words, right? It's true, but why it's true? So remember, what is the ground state? It's this. So what is sigma z I on this state? Let me use a different dummy index here, so that you are not confused. So this means that at some point sigma z acts on one of the pluses, right? And what is it?
Minus.
Okay. So in the end, this state becomes all pluses, but at the j site when you have minus. And then you sandwich it with all pluses. So when you sandwich it, all the pluses give you one, and at the j place, you get this, and these are orthogonal states, so you get zero. So this is zero. So there is no magnetization for G going to infinity, and now you see why I call it the paramagnetic phase. It's like there, that plot. For large G, no spontaneous magnetization. Now we need to explain a very important fact. So let me pull up this. This blackboard. We need to talk about symmetry. I'm sure you have already encountered symmetry considerations in the discussion of the classicalizing model, but here they are much more important. So let me define this global symmetry operator. I call it T, and it is the product over all the spins of sigma x. Notice that this is a non-local operator, so it is forbidden. In what sense it's forbidden? It's forbidden in the sense that no physics can happen through this operator, meaning I cannot put it in the Hamiltonian. Right? There is no interaction that can realize this operator because we forbade in the thermodynamic limit these operators that act everywhere. But mathematically, I can define it and I can use it to prove stuff. So the fact that it's non-physical just means that it cannot appear in the physics that is in the Hamiltonian, but I can use it. By the way, these two operators, the identity everywhere and T, are a group. Because you can see that T times T is the identity, because sigma x times sigma x is the identity on every side. So the set containing the identity and T is a group. And it's in fact a representation of the Z2 group, namely the group with the two elements, the abelian group with two elements. OK. Now, why I'm defining this? Because this is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. If you remember how we defined symmetry, the Hamiltonian, for every value of G, commutes with this operator. Or in other words, if I take a state psi, and in this state, I have a certain value of the energy, and then I compute the expectation value in T psi. So I transform my state from psi to T psi. Because they commute, these two expectation values are the same. You can see it immediately because this is the same that I'm writing this. And because they commute, I can put T here. And now T dagger T is one. And so this is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And the interesting thing is that the ground state, this ground state here, is invariant under this symmetry. So T times the global plus, without index is the global plus, is again plus. You see it, right? Because sigma plus is the eigenstate of all the sigma x's. So that's why. It's a very simple statement. By the way, I can write this thing as a commutation relations too by using the density matrix. I can define psi plus as the projector or the density matrix associated to plus, and then I can write this thing by saying that the commutator between t and psi plus is zero. So that mathematically, I can say that the Hamiltonian and my ground state have the same symmetry, right? Because they do the same thing. Very well. And now let's look. Before I finish, how are the correlation functions here? Well, since not only sigma z has vanishing expectation value, but all these guys in the ground state have vanishing expectation value. So we do not have long range correlation. Okay, so this is, I said phase, but actually I only discussed for G very large, in the limit of G very large. We would like this to be a phase, that is not to be just a singular behavior in one point, but to be somehow true up to a certain point. In the tutorial today, you will show using perturbation theory that the large G expansion shows exactly this, that magnetization is zero, and that correlation functions are not exactly zero, but they decay exponentially, meaning there is a finite correlation length, exactly like in the classicalizing model for t greater than tc. So for G greater than some value, so you will do some large G expansion around here. This is true. Then we don't know yet if there is a critical value here to start with and what would happen there. Now let's see the other limit. G equals zero, which of course I want to call the ferromagnetic phase. Well, at G equals zero, my Hamiltonian is just the Ising coupling. And as you know, because it's not very different in this sense from the classical model, now to minimize the energy, I need to choose either all the spins zero up or all the spins down, which we call one. So the global up is the tensor product of zero on every spin. The global down or global one is this. And now you see that both these states are ground states. So in the ferromagnetic phase, or at least in this limit, G equals zero, we have a degeneracy. Well, if we have a degeneracy, then every superposition of these states is still a ground state. So we cannot say that we have two ground states. What we have is a ground space, LGS. Now this means space, which is the span, that is all the possible linear combination with complex coefficients of these two states. So these two states do not play right now any special role. In fact, I could substitute them with the global plus and the global minus that are also in the ground space. They are also orthogonal. And so they span the same space. This is a basis, and this is another basis. And nothing in physics should depend on the choice of the basis, right? So here we see a difference from the classical case. Because in the classical case, you have two minima. You cannot make superpositions. Either all the spins are up or all the spins are down. But here you have a vector space of minima. Any combination is fine. Now, it's interesting to understand, okay, what happens in this phase? Okay, so what is M? It's the same thing than here. But now, let's say that I am in zero. Sigma z on zero gives us zero. So M is one. Similarly, no matter how far apart these two states, these two sides are, this is also one. So we have a long range order. Again, we do not have long range correlations because the system has magnetized, but there are no fluctuations. M square is one. Okay. So this is like the ferromagnetic phase. But let's dwell 2 minutes more about the fact that there is a degeneracy. Because I want to ask the same kind of questions here. So what happens if I take the state zero and I transform it with the t? It goes into one. And vice versa. So it's not invariant. In other words, this ground state, or also the one with one, and this do not commute. However, if I choose this ground state, it commutes. We already saw it here. So in the ground state manifold, we have states that break the symmetry of the Hamiltonian and states that do not break the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. The states that do not break the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, like plus, give us m equals zero. We already saw it here. So a non-vanishing behavior of the order parameter corresponds to having chosen in the ground space manifold a symmetry breaking state. So spontaneous magnetization happens if and only if we are in a state that breaks the symmetry. So magnetization is spontaneous if the breaking of symmetry is spontaneous, which right now we don't know how this can happen, because they are all the same, these states. Both the symmetric ones and the non-symmetric ones are just states in a vector space. But we have this possibility, okay? We have symmetry breaking states. If for any reason we are in the symmetry broken state, then we have long range order and non-vanishing value over the order parameter. So we see that here we have a symmetric phase, assuming that it's true that the large G expansion shows us that we can extend these results for large G instead of just G infinity. If our perturbation theory tells us that small G expansion holds, then we would have a potentially symmetry broken phase here. Again, I say potential because it depends on what state you pick in the ground space manifold. And it is very tempting to thinking that in between there is a critical point, that something has to go wrong in the analyticity of the ground energy density, ground state energy density. So today in the tutorial, you will do the large G expansion and you will have to prove yourself that the small G expansion also works. So that we can indeed talk about a symmetric paramagnetic phase and of a symmetry broken ferromagnetic phase. So you see that provided that the symmetry is broken, not mathematically, but in the state that you have, this is what gives you order. Order, meaning a non-vanishing value of the order parameter, and long-range correlations are given by breaking a symmetry. In order to break a symmetry, you must have degeneracy. You must have two states. Right? They are the two states that are connected by the symmetry operator. So this is the typical picture of order in quantum matter. There are symmetries at different phases, break them in different ways. Namely, this one, for instance, doesn't break it. This one breaks it. And breaking a symmetry is order. Very well. Tomorrow, we will try to discuss why there is a critical point and then comment a little bit more about the difference between breaking a symmetry in the sense that there are states that such and such, and the fact that this happens spontaneously, meaning if I had the physical system, I would not be able to use these states. Okay. Tomorrow, I mean Monday.